when the real nightmare begins. Should've filled up that restaurant booth instead with Boulder Boss and friends.
So, Mike, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling great.
I only asked because I just saw that you just took some mayonnaise and bananas and put it on a bowl of iceberg lettuce. I'm just checking up on you. I'm just checking in.
Yeah, I'm doing fine after that. It was an experience. It wasn't as terrible as I hoped it would be, I guess, because once I whipped that sauce together, I was like, there wasn't really a strong smell to this either way, so I don't know how this could go, but it was kind of just more disappointing than anything.
We're, of course, speaking about Retro Food Ghoul, Mike's greatest work so far, possibly. I mean, for sure, Virtual Pros is maybe the A number one, but this is coming up fast, because there's a quarter cup of corn syrup in this salad, in quotes, that you made.
Yeah, I have the benefit of not really knowing how anything is made in real life, so... When I tasted it, I was like, this is just like ranch dressing. This is probably how they make ranch dressing, but I have no idea.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Totally. You know, dressing is definitely all corn syrup. You just don't ever expect to be confronted with it like in high relief like that. Yeah. I think the idea was that when I saw, you know, banana mayonnaise salad or whatever, I was thinking more like potato salad or like ambrosia or something like that. And not iceberg lettuce. Not like an actual iceberg lettuce salad.
Yeah.
So it's a surprise.
The cookbook is supposedly some sort of French cookbook or something. I mean, it's not. It's just like a sponsored Hellman's cookbook or something. But so I just wouldn't imagine iceberg lettuce is even an ingredient they would ever use in France, but I could be wrong.
It was funny because it says like, use mayonnaise. We recommend Hellman's or like some other brand.
Yeah.
Best. So it's kind of just like, or are they trying to be humble? Like, you know, you go ahead and use Hellman's. You're going to use Hellman's. Because that's the only thing you can buy.
Yeah.
Anyway, good luck with that. That looked testing. So this experience four, that's when they change everything at Taco Bell. They change their specials. And right now it's the rattlesnake steak stuff, which you finally had. You finally had my experience with it.
Yeah.
Your experience was that it was delicious. You had the burrito originally, and you said it was like one of the best things ever. Then I went and tried it, and it was like they handed me a cup of sauce in a edible cup, basically.
Yeah.
Like, it was a shell filled with sauce and a couple of mangy pieces of shit steak and then, like, two French fries way in the bottom. And I was like, this is fucked. This is the trip Mike's sending me on. This is bullshit. And then you managed to find the same experience yourself.
Yeah, I made the kind of mistake. I mean, it wasn't a mistake. I knew we were going there, but... We went to Taco Bell the night of when everybody celebrates St. Patrick's Day, and I live right near like the main strip of where bozos go to drink on the weekends. Chicago's a huge city. I was not expecting that kind of deal where there would be like one street where everybody went, but there is, and that's where the Taco Bell is. And yeah, so the line wasn't that bad when we got in, but I think they had like a lot of computer orders or something, because there's a lot of orders. And I saw, because they have like the open kitchen thing, and I saw the woman making the rattlesnake fry burritos at a rapid pace, and I was just like, this isn't good. And I looked over, and it was like, it was like two fries, three pieces of steak, and then a whole bunch of sauce. And I was like, man, this fucking sucks. It was probably half the size of the first one I got, maybe even less than half the size. And yeah, for... three something or whatever it is for that burrito, it is totally not worth it. It would be barely worth it if it was on the dollar menu.
Yeah. I thought it was a little spicy, but it wasn't like, nothing was really happening for me.
Yeah. I don't even know if there was a fucking jalapeno on the one I got.
So that's the experience that's going on right now. But you know, when something shows up, other things sometimes go away. And this is a very puzzling list of deaths. The death toll is such that they're, first of all, they're getting rid of the side of rice. Okay, so why? You know, like, what does that get you? What does that get? I guess it gets you space in the menu, but you know.
Yeah, you can't get rid of that just because. So if somebody asks for a side of rice, are they just gonna say no?
It's not in the menu. No.
That's fucking bullshit. They might be taking it off the menu so you can't see it, but you can still ask for it. I'm gonna test this out. As soon as we have clear confirmation that side of rice no longer exists on the menu, I'm testing this out. It's the first thing I'm doing.
They'll kick you right the fuck out of this place. We're losing the black bean burrito, which I've never eaten, so I don't care about that. But I mean, These are things you can make with the app. We're losing the enchirito. Try to make that with the app. I don't know if that's going to work because that's a multi-stage operation. You know, they have to put the sauce and they have to melt cheese on it. So there's no way that you can't type words out in the app. Like, please delicately lay cheese across the top of this burrito and melt it in a microwave or something. That doesn't work. But worst of all, they're getting rid of the Meximelt. Meximelt, which I only just found out was only released in 1988, and you can see the first commercial ever for it on YouTube. I recommend you watch it. Let's all take a moment and watch this commercial. But the Meximelt, which in my expert opinion is the greatest regular experience you can have on the Taco Bell menu, but the worst value. It is pound for pound, it is the biggest ripoff on planet Earth. Diamonds are a better buy. Enchirito can't possibly cost any more than a taco to make. Probably less. There's nothing fresh on it. It's the size of a cigarette, and it's $3. And they've had the money for, and it's always been that way. That, like, when prices were, when they were doing like $69, $89, $109, Meximelt, $3. When they had the 12-cent Taco Tuesday or whatever, $3 for a Meximelt. It's never been a good buy. So why would you get rid of that? Why would you ever get rid of like a cash cow like that? Maybe only one person a month orders it. Who cares? It's $3 every time someone says that word. Why would you ever do away with that? Have you ever had a Meximelt, Mike?
No, I've never. It's because it just looks like a quesadilla, right? I mean, it's not.
Yeah, I don't know what's special. It's, you know, it's like anything else. Like, why is a McDonald's hamburger pretty delicious? You know, There's nothing really special about a McDonald's hamburger, but there's something about the simplicity of that thing that really works. And the Meximelt is just like beef and like melted cheese and some of the pico sauce or something, but it's different. It's the best thing. It's like the best thing that they make.
I was going to say, but I think I see a theory here, though, because you said it was expensive. Yeah. That black bean burrito, because that's not the normal bean burrito, it's black beans. And for some reason, even though black beans are like one of the cheapest things you could buy on Earth, I'm pretty sure that's at kind of a premium price too, and that's why no one gets it. So I guess they just had a meeting and there was like, there's no way we could lower these prices. If we lower these, the $5 box is going to have to be $5.50 or something. So they must have had to make a sacrifice.
They just were looking at the ledger and they saw this huge fuck up. Like, look at these things we made. Look at these weird premium items that we put all over the menu. We gotta ditch this.
This is the aftermath of selling that fucking those giant crunch wraps and gorditas for $5 for a whole meal. Now they're only getting rid of the high end items.
Yeah, I feel terrible. This is kind of an end of an era for me. I came in as a Meximelt and I'm gonna leave as a Meximelt. So this will be the last episode of Border Boss because I don't have anything else to say about.
You can get in on the ground floor and start like a bring back the Meximelt campaign and you know, you'll be the first to do it, so you'll probably have the
hell most popular one. That like the Frito Burrito Twitter account has like a zillion followers and that's the dumbest thing ever, and it's already back and they still have followers. Like, you're done. That should close down. So this week, as that's what we're about to talk about, is the crimes continue. They continue unabated and in a spectacular fashion.
Yep.
This week there was, or maybe it was last week, I don't know, time's moving along.
It's been a couple weeks,
It's been a couple weeks. And by the way, this is Border Boss episode 50, so send us a cake or just Venmo me some money or, you know, whatever. Episode 50, we're doing absolutely nothing special for episode 50. Other than
Except this is, if you guys didn't hear, this is the combined episode now. You're not getting off the hook with only Taco Bell news now.
We're celebrating episode 50 by probably tanking the podcast by making it 2 hours. But you know, this is the way it was originally. Like, we just tacked all holes filled into an episode to see if we liked it. Yeah. We're like, wait, we like doing this probably more than Border Boss. So maybe we can just taper this into being all holes filled full time. But you know, I don't think so. I feel like, you know, I feel like I would lose a part of my soul if we stopped talking about Taco Bell completely.
But you're just going to have to fast forward if you don't want any Taco Bell news.
Or the other way around, you get out early.
Yeah,
you know, the bell rings a whole 45 minutes early on class, and you get to go to the mall. So this week, you know, a Taco Bell in Philadelphia went absolutely bananas. It went wild. So a bunch of people were standing around, and I guess this is the deal at this place. Like, they were standing around, and they were just not getting any orders because they had all these, like you said earlier, all these Grubhub orders had come through and were clogging up the pipes, and you know, people are complaining as they do, possibly more. You know, we don't have the whole story, but people were complaining. The whole staff just jumped the counter chased one guy into the into the parking lot and beat his ass down so hard he forgot what happened. And then when that was done, they looked over at his girlfriend and said, "You too," and beat her ass. And the whole thing's on video. It's in the Center City. Center City District of Philadelphia. Do you know anything about Philadelphia?
Yeah, if you don't know anything about Philadelphia, this is not like the scary part of Philadelphia that Will Smith raps about. This is the pretty, you know, it's a pretty touristy area where you go if you're visiting Philadelphia. So this is right out in the open for tourists to get beat up, basically.
The Center City District has a website that openly brags about gentrification. So I don't know if it's actually has anything to do with gentrification, but like the opening line of this website, it says, Center City District has helped transform downtown ... That's usually shorthand for, you know, we're gentrifying.
Yeah.
Maybe not. It's a big city. Do you really gentrify? I guess you do. You gentrify in big cities, right? I'm from the sticks, so I don't really know how all this stuff works.
I mean, sorta. Yeah. Yeah, sorta.
But what I will tell you is that they have a restaurant week. Where I live, if you have a restaurant week, that means you're white people.
Yeah.
Like you only have a restaurant. You only have restaurant weeks in either, you know, gentrified or very soft parts of town because they sort of involve strolling the streets, probably drunk.
For sure.
You know, the whole story is that they beat this guy down, and he's a little older. He's like in his 40s, so it's not like he was some teenager or something like that. They followed like an adult man, like a dad, out into the parking lot and beat him and his girlfriend, the whole staff, and they all got fired, and he got a $20 gift card.
Yes. Yes.
You know, he called up and said, "Hey, Taco Bell, you know, your whole restaurant just beat me up." And there's, "Oh, sorry for that inconvenience. Here's $20 for your next order."
Mm-hmm. And in contrast, if I don't know if Scott has it in his little police blotter, because it's not really police news, but a man also survived from eating Taco Bell packets in his car for like a week because he was like caught in the snow or something. And they gave that guy a year's worth of free Taco Bell.
Yeah.
And he didn't. I mean, you know, he was on the verge of dying, so I guess that's worse than getting your ass beat, but it's still not, it's still not comparable. My theory, because there's two parts to this whole getting beat up at Taco Bell story, but when I first heard that part, my theory was this guy probably did something bad, where he probably did something racist or sexist or something like that.
Yeah, well, first of all, like the guy who lived on sauce packets, I wanted to know more, but I didn't want to know more because it was like, you know, the way it read in the article I read was that he got out of his car and was like, "Oh shit, it's so snowy. I'm going to get back in my car with me and my dog." Like he was there with the dog. So the dog also ate the Taco Bell sauce packets or something. And, you know, I'm like, you know, if you're in the snow and you got a dog, that's the beginning of an adventure. That's how books start. And this motherfucker turned his tail around and went back and sat in the car for 3 days until someone came to get him. He had the whole world in his hand. He was going to be White Fang. I've never read that book. I don't know if that's about. But I imagine, you know, some Balto. There's got to be some Iditarod ass story where a guy and his dog challenged the world and get home, and this dude blew it.
I also don't understand. I didn't read that closely too. I don't even understand how you get trapped in the snow. I don't know. Was he on a mountain or something? I don't understand it.
It's just really cold.
It's really cold. He didn't want to walk. I understand that.
Maybe his shoes sucked. You know, sometimes you think you're just going out to get the paper and you go out in like flip flops or Crocs or something.
That could be it. That could have been it.
Yeah. So part two of this was that, you know, as soon as this news hit, you know, people were just like, "Oh yeah, don't go to that Taco Bell. You get your ass kicked." And some other guy, like, immediately, he's like, "Oh yeah, man, I'm like a Grubhub or like a Uber, Lyft, something, some kind of delivery guy. I sat in the drive-thru for like an hour. And when I said, 'Hey, you know, I've been in this drive-thru an hour,' they started calling me, you know, homophobic slurs, and they beat me up." It seems to be a running theme with this place. They just don't take it. They don't take it even for 1 second. And, you know, we had the theory that maybe this place is run by an 11-year-old boy.
I've also never worked anywhere in my life that I've had enough solidarity with even one more person where I'd want to group together and beat somebody up over like a work problem.
I don't even talk to coworkers. So you know, when you looked up something, you typed the word crime into Google.
Mm-hmm, crime.
And you got some results that said basically that it seems like when it comes to restaurants, there's Taco Bell, They have a crime. They have a police blotter that's a mile long. And then the next runner up is McDonald's.
Yeah, that has like 10 times as many stores as Taco Bell.
At least, like, so the numbers are like, you know, 5,000 Taco Bells in the world to like 36,000 Taco Bells in McDonald's. Yeah, so to match Taco Bell's legacy of brutality, you have to sextuple the number of available stores and put them probably in terrible places, because McDonald's goes where no other man dares to tread.
We talked about this last episode, but it really does seem that maybe Taco Bell's fine with this, because I think maybe our president has proven that, and, you know, just the internet in general has proven that fucking, what is it, like, honey draws flies quicker or whatever than vinegar? It's not. Yeah. The vinegar draws the flies quicker. every fucking single piece of shit douchebag scumbag that would have just been ignored on a normal message board 10 years ago is now famous, because everybody is basically on the same message board now. So it's just like shitty news travels faster. And, you know, it's like shitty shit news that everybody hates. And then everybody who hates it has to say how much they hate it on the internet. So then it just grows bigger and bigger. So maybe Taco Bell is letting this out, because there's a big difference between saying, oh, that Taco Bell got robbed or that McDonald's got robbed, as opposed to, oh, the restaurant I really like down the street got robbed. Because no one's like, oh, well, that's not my Taco. Or everybody's like, that's not my Taco Bell. You know, it doesn't matter. That's just like a Taco Bell that I have no idea where it is. So there's no real harm in reporting this news, unless you happen to live near the one Taco Bell that you get beat up at. And then, you know, maybe it's bad for Philadelphia for a little while. But unless there's one Taco Bell that has a rash of murders, no one's going to think about it that way.
No, the story that's getting out is that this shit is lit. The Taco Bell's just come out at night. Yeah. There might be a fight. There might be a robbery. There might be a fire. There might be a grenade. Just come out to Taco Bell. Yep. See what happens in your neighborhood. And it kind of makes sense. You know, when we talked about, you said something like, you know, like you've never been in a Taco Bell. Like, you would walk if you had to wait for an hour, and that these people endured a beating.
Yeah.
And I definitely, you can go to Malta, New York, any time of day or night, and just order something. Order a taco. It's like, can you please give me a taco, and then just sit back and wait and see what happens. Somehow it will fail. It'll take them 30 minutes. They'll have forgotten your order, and you have to go up to the counter and say, hey, did you guys forget to make a taco? Say, oh, yeah, we forgot.
Speaking of that, before you get into your next thing, when I was in there the other night when it was super busy, because, you know, it's the fancy futuristic Taco Bell, so they have the big screen that lists all the names for the orders.
Yeah.
At one point, they just shut it off so no one could see.
What a liability. What a liability that screen is. We only have it at the Panera. Like, near me, the Panera has that thing up there, and it's like the airport or whatever, where you can see like who's being served or whatever. Why? Why would you?
I mean, it's some fucking crazy higher-up manager that's like, oh, this is going to increase our efficiency, but not if you tell everybody where the off button is, because they're going to just turn it off.
Oh, shit. We're way back up. Turn off that fucking button. Something else. So, you know, sort of on the topic of what you were talking about, we'll get to it. But eggs, you know, people who follow the Border Boss Instagram, if you don't, it's Border Boss RIP on Instagram. For a while, it was all eggs. I'm thinking about changing it. I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to change it to, but
maybe that has to relate to the podcast. You could do that.
It's Instagram. I do what I want. Is it kayfabe if I talk about what's behind the scene?
No, it's a shoot. Kayfabe is when you protect it.
Okay, so I'm gonna shoot. I'm gonna tell you that you know, that I when I say something that I want to stick to it, and when I say something really stupid, I really want to stick to it. So when I started the Instagram account, what's the song that goes, all I do is win, no matter what?
I don't remember who sings that.
I typed out all I post is eggs, no matter what. That's it. It was on my head.
Stick to it.
Not like that's the curse. And I do eat a lot of eggs, but they're not interesting eggs. I'm not making like frittatas, and like I'm not doing like, you know, I'm not doing anything. I'm not even doing retro food ghoul or anything. Yeah. I'm like,
you're not putting eggs in Pepsi or anything like that.
I'm not putting eggs in soda. I'm not putting eggs on iceberg. I'm not doing anything. I'm just eating like, you know, a bunch of eggs like fried in a pan every couple days. And for a while I was doing the Scotch egg thing, and people seemed to like that, but that's seasonal. I can't keep that up. So, you know, it might change. I might expand the concept, and it probably won't help anybody. But you know, it, but it's but eggs are Taco Bell adjacent or Border Boss adjacent. They're part of the universe. So this week's egg, this week eggs had a weird week. they there's I don't know if you caught any of this. There's a backlash against eggs. Did you hear about this?
I don't think so.
Okay, so when we were young, right? There's the incredible edible egg.
Yeah,
and
eggs, oh, the thing about if you eat the three eggs a day, you're gonna die. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah,
you're
gonna
die. Okay. If you're our age, all the stuff you saw between cartoons was sponsored by either meat, milk, or eggs,
mm-hmm.
or cheese. You know, like the things that feel educational and that feel like you were getting nutrition information, you weren't. You were being sold something by the meat, dairy, and egg councils, mm-hmm. which existed to combat news about cholesterol and stuff like that, and fat and obesity and death. Like, you know, it's not great to drink a bunch of whole milk.
And it's crazy that people still swear by it, that... Yeah. When, you know, I figured this out like 15 years ago, you know, I was like, wait, this is terrible. Like this is not good. There's no book that's going to trick me into thinking this is good for you. This is a horrible, horrible thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, people still swear by it.
I mean, and this, it's not even hidden information that the cheese thing was a scam, you know,
that, I learned. Yeah. Cause I'm like learning a lot from doing the Retro Food Ghoul. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, for one, the reason bananas are in things where they don't belong is because people, we've lived so long on this earth, we tend to forget that at one point, like, a banana was basically like a kiwi or even like a durian, where it was like this exotic fruit. So, so you know, they had to stick it in all these weird places just to be like, hey, we have a banana. That's like a new thing. Orange juice is not that great for you. That whole thing is made up by like the Orange Growers Association. So yeah, it's all bullshit.
So eggs had, you know, they had their moment of they had a crisis of faith where people were like, yo, you got to take the yolk out because it's so full of morgellons and fungus that you're going to die. And that was a whole decade. You know, there was a whole whole Snackwell's decade where people thought fat was going to kill you. And then, you know, then things change. The late 90s and the 2000s hit, CrossFit comes out and people are like, no, you got to eat the whole egg, man. You got to have performance body. You got to have be able to do 600 pull-ups. Butterfly style, or you're a piece of shit, and the only way you can do that is eggs, six eggs a day. Rocky eating eggs, you know, like Hulk Hogan eating eggs, everybody eating eggs. And they came back, they were like, you got to eat the whole egg. When people tell you to eat the egg whites, punch them in the ass, because you got to eat the whole egg. And it, you know, so the 80s were done, the CrossFit science was here, and it changed, and now it's flipped back. Three eggs and you die. They say three eggs a day, which I don't even know how many eggs a day I eat. 40. I just, every time I leave the house, I go to buy more eggs because I thought they were good. We changed. I thought it was like cool to just slurp down like a cup of eggs every time I was thirsty. I eat a ton of eggs.
There is a video, man. I wish I could remember it so I could cite the source, but like years ago somebody made a video about this, and it was like one of those real bland websites that's not really funny, but it was just like, it hit the point so good that it was amazing. And it's just like a time traveler that keeps hopping back in time, like looking at the breakfasts and, you know, going back to time and seeing like what's healthy now and what was healthy then. And yeah, man, it's just, I refuse to believe eggs are bad for you. I know that's kind of like contradicting what I said about milk, but
people have been eating eggs for like 7,000 years. So all of a sudden to come out this and the final stretch, we're going to, you know, I mean, human race is ending, obviously. It's come out in the 11th hour and be like, wait a minute, guys, we should check our diet here. We're eating eggs. Yeah. 7,000 years prove that eggs is what gets you going. You can carry them places. They're in their own package. You can just crack one open and have a drink. So also in egg news this week, and related to what you said earlier, have you heard about Will Connolly?
I don't think so.
Okay, this is pretty good stuff. All right. You're going to want to watch this video when we're done. So this is not good. There was a shooting in New Zealand. It was pretty tragic, like pretty fucking tragic.
I know where you're getting at, but yeah, okay.
So this dude, Fraser Anning, who is like a piece of shit in Australia, and I think we have a few Australian listeners, so they're probably rolling their eyes right now, but this dude's some sort of, you know, right-wing clown piece of shit, and he came out and he said, yeah, the reason Muslims got shot is that there's Muslims in Australia. Of course. So a boy named Will Connolly, who was a boy, a child, walked up behind him and smacked an egg on like smacked an egg as hard as I've ever seen anything smack the side of this dude's head. All right.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. This dude, a grown man, an adult man, turned around and looked at a child, and he's a boy. He's not shaving yet. He is like a Smurf. He looked around, he turned around, he looked at this boy, and he landed a fist as hard as a rock in this boy's face. And then was like, oh, I didn't kill him, so I need to land more fists on him. And just started throwing hands at the boy. And punched a boy several times, a child, yeah, several times in the face. So it's an adult male turned around and like started like wailing on a boy. And then like four other dickheads jump out and jump on the boy, the child.
Yeah.
The infant. They jump on an infant and start like, you know, holding down an infant. They beat and they gave him a little bit of a beating. Nobody touched the adult male who just beat up a child. That didn't bother anybody. So, you know, that's one thing, all right? So this boy's on the ground, like, getting held and getting dealt with. The cops show up, and he says, here comes the bacon for the egg.
I personally love the Spanish.
So it used to be every 2 weeks, and now it's just all the time. All the time. Every time you listen to Border Boss. until we reevaluate. Until we check our numbers and our market share and realize we've slipped. All holes filled. This is now just the second half. This is just you know, put your feet up. This is just the second half of Border Boss. And if you don't like listening to music, then go fuck yourself, and you know, you did your time. Every 2 weeks we become a podcast about talking about the records that we forgot to listen to, the important records that either pertain to our specific spheres of influence, metal and hardcore and SoundCloud rap, or it could be the stuff that you listen to, the boring dads with your lawn mower green white sneakers, whatever the hell you think is important. We'll check that out if we forgot to listen to it. And I am going to write something off completely. I had, you know, we have a spreadsheet where we've captured a few ideas, right? On there are a few kind of Fat Records type bands. Those are all gone.
Yeah.
Those are all gone. They're not coming back because I watched that Fat Records documentary. It's on Amazon. You're like me, right? You watch any rock doc.
Yes.
Like, this is proof that I legitimately don't care what the subject matter is, that I'll watch rock docs. I'll watch like reenactments. What do you call Bohemian Rhapsody? That's like a rock.
A biopic.
You know, I'll watch any of that stuff. I love it all. It doesn't have to be in my to my taste. I'll watch it. But every time they introduced a band, they go band by band on the Fat Records, you know, whatever, top 10 or whatever. And they'll play like a little like synopsis of their discography, a couple songs from each record. Some of these bands are 20 years old, and the first song from like 1988 still sounds like the one that just came out last year. No way. I'm not suffering through that. I'm not going to sit down and listen to an entire album of any of that shit. I heard with my own ears now, my own goddamn ears, there's nothing on Fat Records that I need to check out. So I'm going back and I'm marking those boxes black. I'm putting a black box over those sections of our spreadsheet.
I've made a similar discovery later on in the show, so I'll get to mine too.
So yeah, basically we pick four records that we think are important that we forgot to listen to, and we just listen to them with open hearts and honesty. And to be honest, I'm always looking to be pleasured by these records, even though we're frequently annoyed. And that's part of it. I think we should come up with a rating system, but I don't really have it nailed down yet because it's sort of like they all fall into certain brackets. Either it's too late because we're old, or it's too late because that sound has been outdone and it's not that band's fault. You know, like that's the case, is that you're a progenitor of something. The genre moves on from you, and the next guy should be better at it, hopefully, or you screwed up, or it's garbage, or it's total garbage, you know, or whatever, or it's like, you know, I'm glad I heard this, but I'm never going to listen to it again. So there's these kind of buckets that everything falls into. That's just the cost of deciding at, you know, 76 to start listening to Sonic Youth records. So my first record was Sonic Youth Daydreamy Nation. Daydreamy Nation. Yeah, it's true. I've never listened to Sonic Youth on purpose. I've heard Sonic Youth, you know, they had, what, 100% or whatever. They had, you know, they had a couple hits. Bull in the Heather, that's one, right?
Yeah.
The songs will show up on skate videos, and everyone's seen skate videos. But I've never sat down and listened to a Sonic Youth album.
What about Judgment Night?
What did they do? Cypress Hill?
They had two songs on there. They had Sugar Come By, Get Me High. Oh, no, are they the ones with two songs? No, maybe somebody else had two songs. Forget it.
It's got to be Pearl Jam. Pearl Jam had like six songs in that album. Slayer should have had nine. It should have just been Slayer and Rap Axe. So, Sonic Youth put this out in 1988. And, you know, the Wikipedia says it was their last album before signing to the majors. But it's on Enigma. I don't understand any of the words people use anymore. Enigma Records is part of, like, you know, if I can name your label, I feel like it's a major label. Like, what was the designation? Because it was a part of EMI. Do you know anything about any shit?
Enigma,
like, this was on Enigma Records, which was, I thought that was a major label. I thought that was part of a major label.
If I recall correct, and I'm thinking of IRS. Yeah, I don't know anything about Enigma Records.
Yeah, IRS is sort of indie, I think.
Yeah, they were like the big indie thing in the 80s. Well, not the, you know, not the one, but they were one of the bigger indie labels back then.
All right, anyway, so this was like a double album, and it was supposedly like the last before they hit the big leagues and sold out. But, you know, it starts off with a song named Teenage Riot, and by the time they made this album, they were in their 30s. So, I don't know about that. I mean, you know, like, the thing that people will talk about with Sonic Youth is that they're really noisy and, like, dissonant and, you know, experimental and all this other stuff. And it is. Like, this totally is. It's really hard to hear it now just because of all that's come afterwards. You know, like, I listen to this, and just because of me, like, my experience, whatever, I kind of hear it just sounds like college rock. Like, if I just listen to it and let it play, it sounds like college rock to me. Like, if you listen to REM for the most part and stuff like that, yeah, okay, this is like this is basically Rain and Blood. But I go further than that. I don't check out. This is all holes filled. I don't listen to the first song and say, no, I can't do it. I can do it, and I do it. So I stuck with it, and I found a theme of all four of these records today, which is that there's a beat. There's a beat that you can do, and I'm going to like your record. And you only have to do it on one song. If you have one song that goes, that like 4-4, like that krautrock beat, if you do that in one song and you like sing on the beat and you like really nail it, that's it. I like your album. Every single one of the records today has at least one song that does it. It's that simple. So this album has a song on it called The Sprawl, which is like 75 minutes, but it's actually really, it's pretty good. It's got the beat. It changes up a lot. It's got a little weird stuff. And it's kind of like, this is, I think, the song where it starts to get weird, because then the rest of the album gets really layered, noisy. And he does this thing. I'm going to lose a few people, probably even Mike. But there's a thing that you can do where if you're playing a chord and you just kind of move one finger around, it changes the chord a little bit and it makes it a little weird. And then you move it a little bit more and it makes it weirder, but you just keep playing it. And the repetition kind of makes it like, it's like you're making a mistake, but you've done it four times in a row. So now that's the riff. That's the whole album, is that I made a mistake, but then I kept playing that mistake and it became the song. And that works. Like that's actually a technique. You can use it. I just started four bands. You can just grab a guitar, find one chord that is actually a nice chord, and then move your pinky all around the fretboard while you're doing it. You're Sonic Youth. You're Thurston Moore. I assume he's the mastermind, but it seems like everybody in the band kind of does, pulls weight, because, you know, I think that Kim Gordon, the singer, the other singer and bassist, she has a sick bass tone. Like, even if you don't like the rest of the album, it is a totally good bass tone. But the reason I wanted to listen to this, all right, did you remember the band Struction, Mike?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they're a local band, Struction. I don't like to name names too often. I'm just going to name names because there's no chance this guy listens to our podcast. And it's a weird coincidence that another podcast we're friends with mentioned this band last week, but I'd already planned to talk about this. So there's this band, Struction, and they were kind of like, they weren't that far off from this. They played weird abrasive rock, but with clean channel kind of, you know, like that's the sound. But you know, for a while, our acquaintance Ziedman, who is a fantastic musician, was in it, and he made this band really good. But there's a guy in the band, I'm not acquainted with him personally at all. He always looks like he has a toothache. He's just one of those people who always looks like the world is just irritating the shit out of him. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't know anything about him. He just always looks annoyed, and I kind of feel like Thurston Moore is the same way. I don't know anything about him, never read about him, don't care about him. He just always looks like the sun is in his eyes, or, you know, or yeah. like something's bugging him. I kind of like that. So I wanted to like find something good in this album. I didn't want to like listen to it and say, this just sounds like college rock. Fuck this. No, it's not really like that. I think that there's a lot of like good aggressive stuff on this album. It can be tough to hear. It's easy to dismiss, but it's there. But one of the things I don't like, I don't know about anybody else, but I don't like the vocals on this. I don't like that kind of like Lou Reedy, Bob Dylan talk punk thing. I don't like that. I don't really like that. So, you know, I don't like it from a guy, I should say, because when the Kim Gordon does it, I don't mind it as much. And there's a couple bands. There's some bands out right now. I'm blanking on all their names. There's a bunch of actual hardcore bands where it just has a girl kind of shouting in front.
Yeah.
I kind of like it. I don't really mind it that much. You can really do not much and have that happen in the front of your band, and I kind of dig it. Yeah, so, you know, I kind of think, like, all the stuff that's weird on this album is from a good place, whether I liked it particularly or not. I think that this was, like, a genuine inspiration. Like, these guys listened or had weird atonal aggressive ideas and weird things they wanted to get out. I think they did it. There's a lot of stuff in the middle, like, just kind of, like, does just sound like boring indie rock to me. Not really my thing, but I kind of glad I listened to this. It has a lot of layers. It's really strange if you give it the time that, you know, most people have already given it other than me. But what did you think about it, Mike?
So yeah, Sonic Youth has always been one of those bands. So I went to high school in the mid 90s, which was the peak mainstream appeal to like alternative music. And even like Sonic Youth had kind of like a bigger record at that point. Because before then, Sonic Youth was pretty much relegated to like 120 minutes and shit like that.
Yeah.
That only like older adult weirdos watched. But yeah, so alt rock, like there wasn't like a ton of kids in my school like this, probably as many kids that also that as many kids that like hardcore music. So it's pretty even, like probably five people each or something like that. But and Sonic Youth is always one of those bands where I it was like Dinosaur Jr. where I heard it and I didn't really like it, but I could just be like, yeah, that's fine. I don't like there was bands that the same kids like that would like Sonic Youth and also Live, like yeah. or Presidents of the United States of America or one of those bands.
I wish you hadn't said Live, because when you say the word Live, they get their songs get stuck in my head in the really bad way, because I had a roommate that listened to Live, and now
I knew a lot of mostly actually dudes and girls, but yeah, a lot of kids in high school I knew that really liked fucking Live. And I'd just be like, yeah, I don't get that. I can understand the Sonic Youth because it's kind of weird, but Live is not weird at all.
No.
So I've never really fully... this is probably my first time ever sitting down with like a full Sonic Youth record, and but I've never hated him or anything. First thing you notice about this record is that it is an hour and 10 minutes long.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry about that.
That's crazy long. Like 1988, I don't know jack shit about alternative music in 1988. You know, every once in a while when I was like a little tiny kid, I would maybe stay up and see this weird kind of music. But like the only real video that stuck out from that time for me was that REM End of the World video. That one always stuck out. But Sonic Youth stuff like that was just kind of like a blur in my head. So I don't know if that was kind of what made it alternative, that there's very lengthy, very non-commercial songs or what. But yeah, because like the first track is 7 minutes, and this seems to be another running theme on this show, is where we pick a lot of records that are supposedly seminal that start off with a very long first track, which...
Yeah, what's up with your attention span, everybody?
Yeah, man, 7 minutes is just wild. It's not a bad song. I don't know, because I honestly don't know much history about Sonic Youth, but I feel like this might be one of their jams, too, like the one of them that everybody knows, which is Teenage... What is it called? Teenage Daydream? Yeah, Teenage Dirtbag. You know, they kind of, like I just mentioned, they have a sound that I think is universally pleasing to most people who, have, you know, kind of a broader palette for music, I guess, but I don't think it's most people's favorites. There's definitely people probably even older than us where Sonic Youth is their absolute shit.
Yeah.
But I think for the most part, it's just like one of those bands that's always, you know, right up top, but not the top, because they just have like a pleasing song sound, you know, which is weird because it is a weird, not so pleasing sound, but you know, I think, but you know, that's also kind of a detriment, because I'm pretty sure you can listen to the first song on any Sonic Youth record and just say, no, I don't like this, and never listen to anything else in the discography. Right. They're one of those bands, I think you could just pick any song on their entire discography and put it on and say, I don't need to explore further if I don't like this.
Right.
Uh, The as actually Scott said the same thing, but I definitely tolerate the Kim Gordon vocals a lot more, or Kim Gordon a lot more, and I think all of the songs she's on sound way more sleazy and scummy and dramatic.
That's true.
So I think and it's good that she's not on every single song, so it's kind of like a nice treat when she comes up, like, because you know the first going back to Judgment Night, but that's probably one of the first songs that grabbed me. Even want to check out Sonic Youth in the first part, and Bull and the Heather, and just an update, it was Cypress Hill that had two songs on the Judgment Night soundtrack,
both of which featured Sonic Youth.
Yes, both of which featured Sonic Youth. The only other thing I had to add about this is that song Cross the Breeze, which is a Kim Gordon song, that's the jam on this record for me. Yeah. But you know, the lengthiness, like the last track is technically four tracks. It's four different parts of one song, and I don't think you could be pulling that off. Like I said, maybe in 1988, when you're making like this new genre of music, it's okay to do that. But in retrospect, I don't know. I'm gonna skip it every time.
Like it's time. It's that like the sound of college rock has taken this and done other things with it, and you can't really ever come back from that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like Cross the Breeze, check that out, because it actually has like a doom metal, like a stoner rock riff in it, and it's totally good.
Yeah. So my first one is Have Heart, The Things We Carry. This is from 2006, and so I chose this. This is a hardcore band. I basically chose this most topically because they just announced a reunion show, and people went apeshit and bought the first reunion show out in like 4 seconds, and then you know the tickets were on sale on secondary sites for like $300 in minutes and shit like that. And that's okay when that happens for something like Bikini Kill, which is, you know, this very legendary alt band that I think they're one of those bands that stated, you know, we'll never play another show. So they were like one of those never again type bands, like the Smiths. You know, if the Smiths sold out in minutes, it would make sense. But Have Heart, this is a band that broke up, 10 years ago, if that? So it's pretty crazy. Yeah. But even before that, this record was one of the first records I even put on my Holes Filled list, because around the same time, Axe to Grind podcast did like a time capsule of 2006 or something like that. And when they went over this record, I don't know if it was all of them or just some of them, but they were like, you know, this is one of the most influential bands of the 2000s, and this is probably like the best record of 2006 and all this shit. And I was very active in what you would say the scene at the time. And I just knew by the name it was not for me, so I never really checked it out. And I never, until I heard that Axe to Grind episode, I never thought they were a band anybody gave a shit about outside of, you know, the few years they were active. But apparently a lot of people do, and that's proven by the ticket sales. So I said, why not do this now? It makes the most sense to do it now. Like Scott alluded to with the NoFX pop punk sound, where there's like 10,000 bands you could cancel out. There was a couple of other of these type of, basically, I guess you would say modern, I don't want to say generic, but modern no-frills hardcore bands on my list, like Trial, who's even more 90s, but they always had that sound to me, and I've listened to them, but I never like sat down and listened to a record. Bane is on my list. That's another band that, you know, I've heard a million times, but never really sat down with it. I'm never going to get to those now after listening to this, because I know what to expect. I had to listen to this record probably 9 times just to like grasp something. I don't know if everybody listens to music the same way I do, but usually the first pass through, it's, you know, it's either like, oh, I don't really like this, or oh, this is okay. And, you know, it takes like a few listens for something to like really sink into. And this kind of music, as soon as I heard it, I was like, man, it's going to take me so long to even think of something interesting to say about this, because it's so not my shit, I guess you would say. It's just very, I'm trying to explain it to people who don't know what I'm talking about, but it's so hard because it's just like, it's hard. It's modernized 80s hardcore, what it would sound like in the 90s and 2000s. It's bigger production. It's cleaner production. It might be a more well thought out parts, but it's still just basic hardcore music. It's just with, you know, more money behind it. And, I think that stuff worked in the 80s. Like I like a lot of that the 80s stuff that had the sound, just because it's raw and it's like, you know, it's just kids fucking, not maybe not bold,
It's uninformed. It's uninformed. Like, we have YouTube and all this shit now to tell you how to do this and what amps to buy and stuff. And it's
Like, you know, when you hear Youth of Today do it or something like that, or Gorilla Biscuits, it's like, whoa, you know, these guys are fucking doing it. They're making the sound. But to me, to hear the sound 10, 15, 20 years later, I'm just like, it's not for me. It's not what I want to hear. But I will say, they do... I guess I'll preface this by saying I'm coming out of this... I guess it's not a preface because it's more of a spoiler alert, but coming out of this, I'm still not completely sure what the appeal to this band is. But I will say one of the positives is that they do have like an urgency to their music, which is definitely a big record reviewer term. They play, you know, music very urgently, but they have that. I think they do have like an urgency to their music. Everything sounds like an uphill battle. And I think when you play this kind of pretty generic music, you need that. And that's where a lot of these bands fail. Is they just play hardcore, like Scott said, they watch the YouTube video and they play hardcore and it fucking shows. Like, you could do fucking 10,000 jump kicks in your set, but, you know, if there's no urgency behind that music, it's not gonna fucking matter, man. And you know, I can't imagine, I could probably imagine these guys probably had pretty wild shows. I think I was at one of their shows and did the classic "Sorry, Mr. Set Bro," and I think I stepped out to smoke weed, so I think, you know, I just missed them and I never saw them. The thing that sticks out to me, and I could be wrong, I haven't listened to their whole discography, is, before I get into that, I'm like searching for the appeal to this band, and, the one of the things that stick out is, there sure are a lot of lyrics. This guy has a lot of, like, 10,000% more lyrics than, is accustomed to this type of music, which is, I guess, refreshing in a way. I will say, I was a big fan of the band American Nightmare. And one of the things which I think is like an eye roll now that appealed to me is this guy had like these very poetic, flowery, not normal lyrics for this type of music, and it really stuck out. So maybe that's what the appeal to Half Heart was, because this guy's probably saying some real, real shit. And I did not look at the lyrics while I listened, so who knows? Because I know it's 2006. I'm an old man now. Whatever this guy was saying is probably not going to relate to me at this point in my life, so I didn't look back. But what does stick out is I couldn't find a real huge banger of a song on this record. And not even just a huge banger, but just like one song. And it could be that might have been on a different record or something else, because I know everybody who even hates Bane references that one Bane song. Like, even Scott. I think Scott has a Bane song he likes, right?
Both Guns Blazing.
Everybody references that song.
Song's sick, man.
Yeah, see? And it's kind of just like the Hope Conspiracy was another one of those bands. They came out and they had that one song and they parlayed it into an entire career, even though if you listen to their music, it's really boring. But they had like one really good song. And I don't know if they're one of those types of bands, but that song is not on this record. I didn't hear anything on this record that made me think, oh yeah, I get it now. But they do have a song right in the middle, literally right in the middle of the record. So it could be kind of like I guess I would say like kind of like a strife strategy. Strife, for you guys don't know, had a record called One Truth, and right in the middle, or I think it was like track four or five, right in the middle of their record, they had a song with like a Metallica acoustic intro where the guy like clean sings, and outside of that, Strife has very repetitive, boring music. So like once that song hits, it's like instantly stuck in your head, and. Yeah. Like that's, you know, I could probably still sing the lyrics to this day. I'm not going to on this podcast. That's a Patreon exclusive, but you know, it's just like one of those things that's always stuck with me. And what scares me about Half Heart is they have a song right in the middle of their record called Old Man Part 2. And it has the clean guitars, and it even goes for a second trope and has those kind of like broken AM radio vocals, which is, I don't think is popular anymore. And, it's not a good song. It's probably one of the least good songs on this record. And so I hope that wasn't their attempt to have the one song like Strife, but it wasn't for me, that song. That's about it. I don't hate this. I know it just sounds like I hated it. It's fine for what it is. What it is not for me. I don't think it's ever really been for me. It's hard for me to even compare it to anything. Like Terror is another band like that where, at this point, I think Terror just makes their own music. Like, they make music that sounds like Terror, just like Hatebreed does. But but even Terror, to me, you could listen to that and be like, this is very boring. Musically, this is very boring, because it kind of is. But even them, that speaks to me a little more than Have Heart. This could be the bad record. Maybe I didn't pick the right one. Or it could just be that I've been listening to this music for 30 years and like this specific strain of it will never be for me. I'm glad I checked it out. I was honestly very curious that maybe I did miss out like a big chunk that I would regret, because even stuff like Modern Life is War was very trendy. And I didn't like all the records like everybody did, but there was one record I really, really liked that they did. So usually when there's these like trend bands, I could at least latch on to something, but yeah. For this Half Heart, it was definitely a strike for me. So, but what did you think, Scott?
Well, you know, so I was active during the same time that you were active, but I wasn't really active in the scene anymore. So, yeah. Like, there's a good 10 years straight, probably even longer than 10 years. I mean, it probably starts with Bane, because I never liked Bane, and I never liked the stuff that swirled around Bane. It wasn't really my thing anymore. And from there all the way until, like, metalcore got really stupid again, which is kind of pretty recent.
Yeah.
You know, it's really stupidly heavy metalcore that's out right now. I love it. But there was a whole section where I was playing shows on the reg and I was still sort of young. I wasn't that old yet. And I just had nothing to do with it. You know, I didn't listen to American Nightmare. I used to call them American Underwear. I didn't listen to Guns Up or, you know, Modern Life Was War. They're all interchangeable to me. And Have Heart, like a name like that. Like any of the ones where the name sounds like it's supposed to be like inspirational, like this Stay Gold Pony Boy shit or whatever. Like I just am turned off by that immediately. But I do like the one thing I liked about this album is the gang vocals. They're all over the place and they do a lot.
Oh yeah. Like, they're very good.
I'm curious whether they can pull this off, because it's kind of intricate. They're basically the queen of gang vocals. Like they do like lots of, you know, interlocking, you know, the team comes in and then the singer takes it. Yeah. The team comes in, you know, but overall I listen to this album and it more or less reminds me that youth is really embarrassing. And I don't know how young these people were at the time, but boy, are some of these lyrics really pushing it. There's a song on here called Armed with a Mind. That shit is like some Captain OG Readmore books, check them out shit, dude. Like if you're actually putting out a song that's like, you might be tough and you might be punching me in the face, but I got a strong mind and I read books. That's on here. You put this out. This is an influential album. People bought this. that's part of the legacy. The song that you spoke about, Old Man, that's actually a sequel, believe it or not, because the song before it, which is just a regular metalcore song, references Neil Young lyrics. That's embarrassing. There's a whole line where he goes like, "Old man, take a look at my life and lock." Like that's a Neil Young thing. So the song Old Man follows that. That's shameful, but at least Old Man is kind of like it's like a stupid, you know, it's like a pick up the change mosh song. Like, yeah. I didn't even know. Is there even lyrics on it? I think it's just supposed to be like a Counting Worms thing or something like that. It's just supposed to be a mosh part, which that's fine. Like if you, you know, follow up your meaningful, reference to Neil Young by saying, you know, feel free to slam and people can just pick it up. That's cool. But you know, there's a fucking song on here about how meaningful tattoos are. They have a song called Something More Than Ink.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those like LinkedIn employed memes taking song form. Like they're just talking about like, don't give me shit. My tattoos mean a lot to me. Like what? Fuck you. So the song that I think is a hit, The Machinist.
Okay. Yeah.
I've heard it spoken about. I assume that's their, you know, that's their hit. Has a mosh call where he just goes, what the fuck? I like that a lot.
Yeah, this guy was just on the X to Grind podcast too, and he sounds, you know, he sounds really smart. He's not like a goon or anything. I think he might even be like a teacher or something. So
self-aware. Like I think that there's no real question about, you know, like they talk about these things and they say that they've outgrown this.
Yeah.
This
and I just think, I think me and Scott were never the right age for this. Like we would have had to take a time machine 10 years in the past to 2006 to even maybe grasp this. I think
it might have to be like an all holes filled sister podcast. We'll do something. I don't know what we call it, but we'll do one where we find albums we really like, but I give you the lyric sheet.
yeah.
And you say, oh yeah, no, this doesn't work, man. This really doesn't work. So I did Flipper, the band Flipper. The album is called Album Generic. It just has a yellow. It's just like a yellow. It's like the generic products they used to make in the 80s. If you're old enough to remember that, there would just be aisles and aisles in the grocery store that said generic food. They said generic on the can. It's not a joke.
So no frills.
Yeah. It was like a cost saving, you know, how to beat the high cost of living thing where they would be very simple. There would be like a yellow can with black text, just like this album cover, or there'd be like white and blue and it would just say, you know, soda or like pasta or something like that. And they actually made fun of it in Repo Man. If you see all the products in Repo Man are labeled that way, that was real. That actually was a situation.
Also Roseanne did it too. And it looks like,
did they?
Yeah. And it looks like people just didn't have like a set design, but no, that's how boxes used to look.
Yeah. So that's what the cover of this album, I assume, is referencing. It's very close. If not, it's an album from 1982, from San Francisco. So you know what, I spent some time. I knew about this album. I knew that this was one of those bands that was supposed to be like really kind of dark and heavy for its time, and that they influenced, you know, Nirvana and all these others later. Like Nirvana, I don't like Nirvana, but they were heavy. You know, like Nirvana sounds really like their sound was really heavy. The stuff that like the Melvins and the stuff that they were into is pretty legit. So I checked this out, just sort of knowing that it's one of those things that better bands were influenced by. And it's tough to get it from this album, I'll say. This more or less just I thought it was remarkable that this is 1982, all right? 1982, they had already dialed in and perfected the sound of the awful band who opens for you in a basement. like, you know, when you are in a basement well beyond your expiration date and you're starting to feel bad, like, why am I still playing these shows? This is all the bands that lead up to you sound like this. You know, they have one riff, they play it for the entire time, and then a guy just kind of like barks, like sort of pointlessly over the top of it, like, you know, without even any real rhythm, and just says weird stuff. It sounds sort of distant and messy because they're playing through Krait Excalibur amps, and two guitarists are plugged into one amp. The bassist didn't even bring an amp. He's just plugged into the PA, if there's a PA. That's the sound of Flipper. And I think that they meant to do this. I don't think that this is them being inept. I think that they wanted to do something kind of primitive and simple, and they wanted to shout kind of simple, iconic lyrics and stuff over the top of it, and they do it. Like, that's what this is. Like I said about, you know, Sonic Youth, that they'll play the wrong thing four times in a row to make it work. Here's what it sounds like when you do that for a whole album. If you just say, you know what, like, we're just like, this riff's going to work. We're going to show you that it works by playing it for 6 minutes. And I'm going to show you that this is my favorite line of lyrics by singing it over and over and only having this one line. The song Sex Bomb is literally seven words or six words. I just popped over to some of their later albums and just skipped around. And it sort of reinforces what I said. They did this on purpose because the next things that come out sound like this, but better. Like, they actually turned this into something and it kind of works. Like, the later stuff is actually pretty cool. It's like primitive, I don't know, sludgy, weird proto grunge. I definitely would have liked this when I was 16, because the band that I joked to Mike that I was going to start a separate mini series within the podcast to talk about, the album Blowhard by the band Duh. And I really want to talk to you about this album, but I don't think it's right for me to do it. But the point is that it's silly but serious, which is, I like that. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it's like they're not making, they do some stupid jokes, but it's not, it looks like they don't know they're making jokes. It's like they keep a straight face and they do silly things. They play it really heavy. It's messy, but they never stop. I think the worst thing that can happen is when a messy band stops and says, wait a minute, let's start that song again. Yeah. That's the worst thing. So if your band sucks, but you guys all just like nod your heads, look at each other like, yeah, fuck this, we're going to keep going. That's a maneuver. That's great. You could do that forever. And they kind of make that work. The only thing that I don't love is that. So once again, this album has the beat. A couple of songs really dial in that. Dial in that part. The singer's right on top of it. Like singing. Nom, 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 nom. He's like landing on it. And then he just gives up, which is the thing that I don't love about it. He just kind of does the basement punker thing where he forgot how the lyrics go over the song. He just goes. Nom, 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 and just trails off and does whatever he wants. I don't really love that. I feel like you should practice your songs before you record. But Mike, what did you think of Flipper's generic?
So I wasn't really familiar with this. I think I listened to this once years and years and years ago, and I was very surprised because the name Flipper always sounded like some kind of pop punk band to me. And they were one of those bands that would just be like vaguely referenced in record reviews. And you can never pinpoint what they sounded like from how they were being referenced. And so I just always thought they were a punk band. So I think when I heard them, you know, back when I was probably like 23 or something, I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's not what I imagined. And then I went on with my life until today. And I think the first thing I will say is, as Scott pointed out, the very generic album art, there's a very lucrative streetwear brand right now, or I don't even know if it's considered street band brand wear, because I think they make too much money, but it's called Off-White.
Right.
And their whole deal is basically the flipper cover. So anybody who thinks that's like some trailblazing idea, just look back to 1982 and see that flipper beat that guy by about 40 years.
Is it one guy? Is Off-White
one? Yeah, it's one guy who started it. I'm sure it's like a big company now, but yeah. Right. And like all he does is like he does collabs with Nike and basically does a white version of like the flipper album cover, where it'll say like soul on the soul and stuff like that. And that's just like, yeah.
In the default font, like just in Calibri or whatever.
Yeah. It's just like that. I'm really glad this band, I think they formed in 1981 or something like that. I'm very glad they existed back then, because it's not really a sound you would immediately hear and go punk, but they were definitely a part of the punk scene back then. And that's cool. I made a joke in my notes saying that, you know, if this didn't exist, who knows how many more Have Hearts there would have been. So that's good. I think that's kind of mean right now. So so I take that joke back. But it's true, though. You know, if this band didn't exist in the punk scene in 1981, who knows how shitty it could have been. So I'm glad this band sounded this fucking different back then, when punk was still very new. So that's cool. This is another band, a callback to what I said last episode, and a callback to what Scott said, but this is another band that sounds like they should have an instrument playing vocalist to excuse the vocals. And that is one thing that I will give credit to any basement opening band, is they usually do have an instrument playing vocalist. So they did evolve into doing that. So
you can do anything. You can do anything you want. If your singer plays an instrument, you can get away with it.
Yeah, you can get away with it. But with this band, it's kind of weird. But as Scott said, I read up on it, and they were kind of intentionally going for this weird primitive sound. So it makes sense. But, and I think, I don't think this guy stuck around for their whole tenure. I think only the guitarist and the drummer stuck around, and then they got a different guy. I could be wrong, though. I think this guy might have even been dead. He might be in heaven right now. So rest in peace if you're dead.
The problem with this band is he was dead while he was in the band for a while.
There's a song called Life is Cheap on here that has the Cookie Puss vocals, and I love that. I think that song really sticks out. And again, it's kind of silly listening to it now in 2019, but in 1981, man, I was 16 in 1981, hoo boy, I would have fucking loved that song. Do you think there's a song on here called Way of the World, which is probably the closest this comes to sounding like a, you know, a pop song, I guess, not, you know, pop in the definition sense, but something that's would be catchy. And so I think that's the hit on this. But yeah, I enjoyed this. I'm never going to go back to it. I think Scott covered it. There's many bands that have kind of evolved the sound over the years, including the Melvins and Nirvana. But I am very glad I listened to it. I'm very glad this record exists.
It's really, it's camp. Like, I need to restate, this is 1982. Yeah. That I can't put my head in this situation.
Yeah.
Like, I was alive at this time. I was a boy, I was a child, but I know other stuff from this era. I can't think back hard enough to like what it must have been like to hear something this kind of futuristically bad.
Yeah.
In 1982.
This is it's really, like the Captain Beefheart of punk music, basically.
Yeah. Seriously. And the other thing they do that I like is that they sell like the jokier thing. So they like their future albums have these really silly, almost like Keith Haring looking fish,
yeah,
crossed out eyes. But there's nothing funny about it.
Yeah.
Like, it's silly, but it's not funny. So
that's yet another reason why I always thought they were a pop punk band, because it's very pop punk.
Yeah.
So my last record, are you done?
Can we
move on? Okay, so my last record is Big Black, Songs About Fucking. That's F**king. But yeah, songs about fucking. I basically chose.
I don't think I ever noticed that they censor it.
I don't think it's on everything. I can't remember. I was just about to say, I chose this because this is one of the very many records on this show that I've done where I've actually owned the record for years and years. And I don't mean I own the MP3 or even the CD or cassette tape. I own a big ass 15 ounce vinyl record of this, and I've just never listened to this. It has one of the most iconic covers, I think. Is that stolen art? Did somebody do that for this record? Do you know?
I don't know. I've never looked into it. It's, I mean, I assume that's from actual anime, because they're creeps. They're creeps about that stuff. Yeah. But
Yeah, I'm sure I could look up on the internet and there's probably 10,000 people fucking screaming right now. Like 10,000 people listen to this, but, you know, screaming. But yeah, it has very iconic cover art. It's very electric green and just like it stands out. So that's probably why I own it. But and also famously, if you don't know the cover art and the album title, Steve Albini is in this band who was like the studio engineer extraordinaire. That is where you go if you want to make abrasive music, but not too abrasive, just abrasive. Mm-hmm. Right. So given those facts and never listening to this and knowing Steve Albini from his other work, not his personal work, but, you know, just the bands he produces and stuff like that. And I thought for some reason, I thought this was going to be like his serious band. And by serious, I don't mean, you know, I don't mean like Aerosmith or anything, but, you know, serious as in this is the accessible band that Steve Albini did. That's what I always like was under the assumption, like, you want to hear something that's good and not weird, it's probably Big Black, but that's not true. That is not true with this. But given that, I was expecting this to still be kind of over my head in a way where, you know, maybe I would say, I hate this, and Scott would say, no, you're just a moron because you don't know how to play guitar or something like that. and I don't even think it was really over my head because this honestly just sounds, it sounds like two things. It sounds like the again, the broken radio effect that was used in the early 2000s to mid 2000s a lot. It sounds like that, but just never turned up. Like that one Dead Guy song that does that for about 40 seconds and then it just like fucking bursts. It just never bursts. Like it's just always that song for a whole record, for a whole half hour record. It either sounds like that or it sounds like somebody went in the studio and turned some knobs down to zero and other knobs up to 10. And that's your sound, Steve Albini. That's what you did. I figured out the secret. I cracked the code. That's what it is. And I will say, the first run through of this, I was like, I fucking hate this. This is rough, man. This is just like for the sake of being weird, making a sound that sounds like this. I hated the second song is called The Model, and it's a Kraftwerk cover. I hated that on the first listen, but you know, after a while, I got into it. And that's the thing. I think that's the thing with this record. It's just like, I'll still say that I don't really would ever prefer a whole record to sound like this sound, which is kind of very tinny, very high on treble, very low on bass. It's very screechy, I guess you would say. I wouldn't say like black metal, but kind of in that realm of where, oh, you're doing this kind of on purpose. And that's a shitty thing. But so it takes a while to get into, and I actually wasn't expecting this. This is a little more industrial than I expected. There's some real drum machines on this back in 1988, and I wasn't really expecting that. And it's cool. That's cool. I like the industrial stuff. The song "Bad Penny" has a part that sounds like the intro to a Quicksand song, "Omission," and I'd like to think that Walter, whoever wrote that part in Quicksand, was like, no one listens to Big Black. We'll just steal that. No one will notice.
I'll have that.
Yeah.
I'll have that part.
I said after repeated listens, I do enjoy this a bit more than I did when I first listened to it. I do think the production is a little try hard, but as I said, I was under the assumption for some reason, this is the one Steve Albini band that had like normal production, but I was wrong. I will say if this was a 7-inch, if the song Fish Fry, which I think is my favorite song on this, and maybe the Quicksand Bite song Bad Penny, if that was just like side A and side B 7-inch, and that was something that I just picked up in the 90s, I'd been like, man, I fucking really like this 7-inch a lot. But I just think it wears down. Like Floor, before they became the band everybody knows, they had like a couple 7-inches that I really liked a lot, but it was a very weird sound where the vocals were really in the back, like really, like almost like the studio was haunted. And just this kind of, again, like very abrasive for the sake of being abrasive type sound. And I love those records, but man, if Floor made a whole entire LP of that sound, I would have probably really hated it. And so I think, you know, obviously Big Black doesn't need my approval because I think they're pretty legendary as it is. But yeah, if this was a 7-inch, I would have definitely dug it, but not really as an LP. I liked it. I'm glad I listened to it. And I will say the last track is called Bombastic Intro because, you know, get it. It's the last track. This intro. And it's literally a bombastic intro like you would do. And that's really corny now. But back then, 1988, that's pretty hilarious. So this is a good record. It's not completely for me. I can get into it. But I am glad I listened to it. I'm probably never going to listen to it again. But I can respect it, even though it's not completely for me. But what did you think, Scott?
Well, I'd heard this album a long time ago because, you know, this cover, the album, the band's called Big Black.
Yeah.
Like, that's the album song's called Songs About Fucking, and it has like this dirty anime cover, and I'm like 17 or whatever. And I don't watch dirty anime, but I have to hear this. And it was probably at Rhino Records, which was like one of the first places in all, like in my part of town. It was a record store that opened up around the corner. That was all like indie music and had a used bin that was gigantic and you could listen to everything. That's the first time that ever happened in that part of town. I could walk. It was terrible. It's probably why my life was ruined for 15, 20 years, because it was right around the corner from where I lived. So I could just go and that's where all my metal went when I tried to de-metal. It's, you know, it's where all my ska came from, all my industrial and like weird shit came. But they definitely had a, you know, they had a whole section where like some dickhead was trying to cater to the punks, and he had the Gigi Allen records and shit like that. So of course this was out. I listened to it and I didn't get it back then. You know, this isn't, I don't know how you would. I don't, like, I guess unless you had a wise older boy to show you what was good about this. This is something that I think would be a tough sell to a younger person unless it just hit them right. And it didn't hit me right. It wasn't for me at the time. You know, and there's another thing that went on back then that I was actually just talking to I only ever talk about Toms, right? All my friends are Toms. So I was talking to one of my Toms about how he brought it up that old punk bands and old hardcore, you know, it used to be more of a thing to do a character in a song, to do like every album had like a hillbilly song or something, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or you would do a song where you were supposed to be like a New York wise ass guy. It was just way more normal to do these character songs, and you could use that to slip in, for instance, some N-bombs, mm-hmm, or, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, or some other hateful language, because you're not really saying it. You're in character. You know, I don't know. This isn't me. But there's nothing that a white loser loves more than thinking he's getting away with saying the N-word in public. Mm-hmm. That's like sweet nectar to certain types of dudes, is to be out on stage and be getting away with saying something, some naughty language like that.
Quentin Tarantino still does it.
Oh my God. He's built a zillion dollar empire on. So, you know, like that sort of that vibe of doing a character in song and getting away with some harsh language in it. I feel like that's all Steve Albini does. And I don't know if he's ever in character. I don't know anything. I don't know much about his point of view. Shellac's the first band of his I ever heard. And I like parts of it. In fact, Eviction has some Shellac influence, believe it or not. The band that we were in together, not know this. There's a song that definitely has a shellac part, even though I'm not a big shellac fan. But I liked the clanky guitars. I like the harsh sound. I think it's on purpose. He spends a lot of money to do it, because his whole band, you know, I don't know if it goes all the way to Big Black, but his bands are famous for playing these. It used to be Travis Bean like metal neck guitars. Now I think he makes his own, or some company makes them for him. They're called like electric guitar. They're just called electric guitars or something, and they have metal necks. And, you know, that gives it like a harsher sound, whatever. The point is that he runs that through this big box that costs as much as a house, and all this nonsense that he does to get that like clangy, you know, tinny sound. And it's his thing. And I think he sells it. I could see not liking it, but I think it just hit my ears right. I knew what he was going for. I don't mind it. This album is all that. He took all the low end out. He's like, fuck that. I can go lower. I can go harder. I can make this just be like someone's hitting a rice paper against your ear every time my guitar hits a note. So yeah, the clang guitar is doing a thing. You know, I also didn't remotely realize this was an industrial band.
Yeah. And
I don't know. I think it's all drum machine.
Is it?
It seems that was okay. Like, that was one of their groundbreaking things, was that they brought a drum machine into edgy rock. And, yeah. So, you know, I'm listening to it now, and Bad Penny rules. There's a couple other songs. The whole thing kind of sounds like, to me, this sounds like something that would have come after Ministry, like Revolting Cocks type shit or stuff like that, that I loved when I was a kid. I like this sound. I like this stuff. It's got the beat. It's on here. He does it several times. He does it in several different ways. Bad Penny was the first one where I was listening. I was like, wait a minute, I don't hate this. And then I kept going further and further. And I also share your disdain for the model, but I'm kind of soft on it. Like, yeah. I'm a huge Kraftwerk fan. I don't want to hear you cover Kraftwerk. I don't want to hear anyone cover Kraftwerk. It's just like, it's always silly. It's always stupid. maybe for the time, it's 1988, maybe, you know, like everybody was doing silly covers on their albums back then and ironic covers. My favorite thrash album, I've talked about several times this week, Dead Horse, Peaceful Death, and Pretty Flowers, has a B-52s cover on it. That's terrible.
Rock Lobster?
They do Rock Lobster.
It's not terrible. It's like, it's so good. I hate the B-52s version. I love the Dead Horse version.
I didn't know it was a cover.
I didn't know it was a cover either when I was a kid, but even after finding out, I don't think it's terrible.
Well, I feel like because that comes right before a song called Alpo where they just yell. and I feel like it's too much too soon. Like they do like three jokes in a row. I'm like, yeah, you could have cut one of those. So it, like they lose me on that section of the album. So yeah, I don't love that. But other than that, here we are. Mike, episode 50. You've done it. You picked an album that I think I'm going to listen to again on purpose, maybe more than once. I genuinely, like, as this album went on, I just had to, like drop the act and say, you know what? I actually like this a lot. I think this might be for me. I don't know whether Steve Albini's canceled. I don't know. Like, you know, he's got a big mouth. I'm sure he said some off-putting things. I don't know whether he's a good guy or a bad guy.
I mean, he was in a band called Rape Man, so.
That's what I'm saying. Is that in character?
I don't know. I don't know if he can be in character, so I don't know.
Like, I think maybe he was just trying to make that work for 10 or 15 years. He's like, you know what? Not a lot of people watch anime yet. Maybe I could just be a fucking creep.
People discover he was in a band called Rape Man, trust me, he's going to be canceled. I don't think he's going to have any excuse to hide behind.
So I need to just speak really fast. I need to get this in under the wire before you guys cancel Steve Albini for Rape Man, that I really like the album Big Black Songs About Fucking, and I'm going to listen to it again. Episode 50, we did it. Motor Boss and Friends.